Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly magazine of crime and mystery fiction. To give you a sense of what the magazine is about, we offer podcasts of stories from our back issues. Most of the stories are read by the authors themselves. Today we welcome Shelley Costa. She reads her story Stranglevine from our November 2012 issue. Shelley Costa is the author of You Can Only Die Once, which will be published June 2013 from Simon & Schuster Pocketbooks. This book is the debut of her Italian restaurant Cozy Mystery series. Shelley is also the author of The Everything Guide to Edgar Allan Poe, published by Adams Media. She lives in Cleveland and teaches creative writing at the Cleveland Institute of Art.
Okemah, Oklahoma, June 3rd, 1911. I don't see him first thing, or even second thing. And when I do see him, I don't recognize him. He's just that much too far upriver in the boat. Me, I'm standing downriver from the bridge, where it all happened not even 2 weeks ago. Still looking for their shoes, hers and L.W.'s. It's not that I think I'm likely to find them. They might have been stolen, or they might have been left back at the farm in Darktown and then stolen. Nothing lasts long around here, I'm noticing. But every day after school, where Mama teaches fifth grade, I come back to the bank of the Canadian River, and I look. I have a good long stick I use for pulling at anything that looks like a shoe out there, not too far from the river bank. Sometimes I think my heart will break all over again if I don't find those shoes, but then sometimes I think it'll break if I do. I only know for sure I have to come. It gives me something to do, because when you're 12 and the whole place is run by the devil, it's really all you can do. If those same worn-out shoes I saw in Laura and L.W. every day are all I, Josie Template, can save, I figure at least it's something. It's early June now, and the bank manager walks to his job managing the First National Bank like nothing ever happened. Only I notice he got a new suit from the Sears Roebuck catalog, like maybe he needed something clean and new. And the McLaren Bay horse and wagon that brought them here, brought all of us here, really, that night 2 weeks ago, sits hitched outside the hardware store just waiting for its next load, its next delivery. But this time, maybe something different from humans. That might make a nice change. And the women whisper and just beat the rugs harder and argue longer over the clothesline, because when the whole place is run by the devil, that's all they can do. And Ella Joy Darnley has cuts and bruises, which Mom and me notice. But then we live next door to Sheriff Darnley and his poor wife. And that silly parson, just days after it all happened, was redder in the face than usual and delivered that week's sermon on charity and forgiveness and your brother's keeper, nothing new there, in a voice so loud he nearly choked on his own spit. And then he acted like he had done his job. He slammed the church door shut behind the last few to leave. The Knights got together at the lumberyard to plan the annual ice cream social, that's what they said. But we all knew it was to get their stories straight, in case somebody comes around to ask, some reporter or that traveling magistrate who must have got lost. And the jail got swept out with no more care than usual, because this here is Okemah, Oklahoma, and nothing ever happens here. Nothing except love mischief and horse thievery and shoplifting and whatever the slick strangers breezing through town try to talk you into buying or believing. But then, there he is, floating, not moving, in a skiff, half in and half out of the water. I can hardly make him out for sure there, the sun casting the shadow of the bridge over that upriver patch of riverbank. Suddenly I hear a cow lowing somewhere close, somewhere through those woods on the far side is a pasture and just a regular day for cows. All they have to worry about at nightfall is whether they get back to the barn all right. I set down my stick and head toward the skiff, keeping the bridge between me and the sheriff, because Tom Darnley isn't the kind of man who appreciates being taken by surprise. which in some ways I see as I sidestep a water moccasin coiled on a little rock pile half out of the water, is how all the trouble started. Trouble is what they call it at the Five and Dime, and damn foolishness is what they call it at the bakery. Righteous vengeance is what they call it at the lumberyard, and the regrettable incident is what they call it at the sheriff's office, in case anyone takes notes or cares. Looks like no one does, except for me, who drags the Canadian River for shoes. When I'm full under the bridge, a wagon crosses over, the driver clicking at his horse to giddy-up, haw, giddy-up, like hellhounds are in pursuit. I hope they are, I truly do, because now I know you can't tell the good folks from the bad. It's Darnley, all right, there in the rotten old skiff someone left tied up at that bend in the river and never came back. From the cover of the bridge, I secretly watch him for a few minutes just to see whether he moves. He doesn't. But I'd sooner trust the water moccasin with its still black eyes open than I would Tom Darnley with his blue eyes shut. At least with a snake, you know what you're getting. I slip out from my cover and get closer, close enough to see the man sprawled on his back in his sheriff's uniform, his mouth hanging open, his hat upside down on the riverbank. One of his big hands lies across his chest like a kid's, his beefy fingers half curled. Is he sleeping? The other hand hangs half out of the boat. One knee is bent, and the other leg is twisted at a funny angle. Is he dead? Could be he's dead. But from what? No gunshots, far as I can tell. And here in Okemah, firearms is just about as creative as they get. These are impatient folks out here, Josie, said Mama one time, soon after we'd moved from Philadelphia for a new life after Papa died from the consumption. And guns suit them. I get up close to the sheriff and I look him over. I know about you, mister, I tell him in my head. Clean-shaven, hair cut so close you can't even tell what color it is anymore, the barrel chest pulling at the shirt buttons, the cowhide boots he makes Ella Joy polish out on the back steps, sometimes her eyes so swollen shut, I don't know how she can see what she's doing, the thick white scars on his neck he claims he sustained in a bar brawl with a Creek Indian with a skinning knife over a woman. Mama says here's where he swaggers. But pretty much everyone knows it was a mill accident when he was a boy. No one will say, though, because the last man who laughed the truth at him had both his legs broken one moonless night on his way home from Dugan's Bar. I see the worn black holster at his hip, and the gun, and the badge that's too much in the shadow of the bridge to gleam, and the empty bottle of Jim Beam that has slipped to the bottom of the skiff. I think he's dead. And I raise my arms and spin. I actually spin here on in the riverbank in my blue cotton dress and high-buttoned shoes. The stones churn and rasp under my feet, and my circles get wider as I find the sunlight there on the bank of the Canadian River. Daylight and scrub and a dead sheriff and a blot of blue. It's the bridge. All go soft in the tearful blur of my spinning, where anyone passing on that bridge can see, but nobody does. Because here I am, crying for Laura and L.W., finding something better than lost, soaked shoes, finding the devil dead in a rotting skiff with great gaping holes in the bow. I hear a sound, a deep rumble, and look up to the bridge, shading my eyes, expecting another wagon or maybe a shiny new Model T. Just other weak, good people finding their way across the land God left behind. But there's nobody crossing, and I turn to the skiff. The chest, that chest, rises and falls. And even in a half-death of drink, a hand flies to its holster. And all of a sudden, I'm back in the chicken coop, back in that coop where it all started, and all I can do is crush my whole arm against my mouth to muffle the sound of the cries. I truly don't think I can stop. Last May 21st. I tore up the road to Darktown on my bike, leaning hard over the handlebars, spitting away the dust from my lips. I hollered something I thought sounded like a Creek war whoop as I passed Laura and L.W., making their way home in their wagon, pulled by Gorgeous the mule. As I wheeled by them in the bright sunlight, L.W.'s teeth shone in his friendly black face, and he yelled, "Haw!" to Gorgeous, like we were racing. Him and me and his mama Laura started to half-stand, worried about whether I was paying attention. I heard her talking me down about dang fool tomboys who tear around on dangerous machines like reckless savages, but I knew it was because she loved me. Standing tall on my pedals where the road dipped down, I bumped along and turned, fingertips just grazing the handlebars, blowing them kisses and pushing my red hair out of my face as Laura fell back against the wagon seat, fanning herself. Laura Nelson worked their farm alone since L.W.'s father, Roster, ran off before the baby was born 3 months ago. Laura shooed the mule, boiled the laundry, plowed the small field, and built the new coop when the chickens got to be too many. But she still thought young ladies, leastwise young white ladies, she said, shouldn't go tearing down dirt roads on bicycles. Seemed to me she was hogging all the fun for the girls down in Darktown. When she came to town to clean for my mama, she thumbed through the latest issue of the Ladies Home Journal, amazed by the pictures of lingerie hats you could make if the laundry didn't have to get boiled, or the vegetable silk hosiery fine ladies got to wear when they weren't shoeing the mule, or the Lotal hand cream you could buy for skin smooth as a baby's backside, which came in handy after a day behind the plow. Mama sent away for a jar of Lotal and gave it to Laura for her last birthday. Laura cried and rubbed a bit of the white cream no bigger than the size of a tiny pebble into her rough and beautiful black hands. She liked it so much that when the baby came, she named her Lotal because she liked this word for cream that was soft and sweet-smelling and came from far away. Maybe Lotal the baby would get to go someplace far away from Okemah. Maybe it would bring her white luck. I got to the farm first, just ahead of Gorgeous, who was suddenly acting lively. The Nelson farm wasn't much of a farm. Pretty much dirt and scrub and a patch of field that Laura and L.W. planted just for their own keep. But it had been homesteaded by Laura's granddad, a freed slave, so the land held her. She kept the shacks in good repair and the harvest canned, pickled, and root-cellared. She kept an eye on L.W., who she called her slow and dutiful boy, because he was 15, which, as she put it, the good Lord knows is the age of devilment. As far as I could tell, both the good Lord and the devil were matters of no great concern for Laura, who was too busy to pay much attention to either, although she liked using them in her conversation. There was a dappled horse whinnying softly in what Laura called the barnyard, that space between the chicken coop and the cabin, the reins flung loosely over the branches of a buckbrush. I set down my bike and crossed my arms, waiting to see who was creeping around the Nelson place while Laura and L.W. were off in town. As their wagon caught up to me, I heard baby Lotal fussing and turned to see Laura's eyes looking sharply around her property. She stepped down out of the wagon, holding a hand out, palm down to L.W. and me, which was as good as telling us to stay put. Just then a man appeared around the far side of the plain little cabin. He caught sight of us and headed our way. It was the deputy sheriff, name of George Loney, and I admit I felt relieved, not just because he was one of the handsome fellows in Okemah. Pretty much all that took was regular features and ears that lay flat against his head, but because he always brought little gifts like flowers he picked himself or, from what I could tell, hiding behind our curtains, what looked like frosted cupcakes to Ella Joy whenever he snuck into the house next door to ours, which was pretty reliably when her husband Tom Darnley was off on a sheriff's call, far out in Okfuskey County somewhere. Mom and I would just give each other looks, thinking George Loney might just as well go pitch a tent in a grizzly's den for all his life was worth if Tom Darnley got wind of that gossip. But the deputy genuinely seemed to like poor Ella Joy, which was more than we could say about her husband, who crowed around town about how much he loved his fine, sweet, girly wife, the beauteous Ella Joy. Even I know there's something wrong when you can't tell the difference between love and hate, and I'm just 12. George Loney came over to us, swiped off his uniform hat, and gave us a small smile. "Miss Nelson," he said. Laura's lips barely moved when she said, "Deputy." because I knew for a fact she didn't want any white man on her property for any reason whatsoever, because, as she once told me and Mama, their fun ain't fun, and their serious is deadly. "Ma'am, we got a report of stolen goods here at your place," Laura said with some spirit. "Who told you that?" "I don't rightly know, but the sheriff told me to check it out." "Exactly what are these stolen goods, deputy?" "Saddles, saddlebags," said the deputy. "Rifles, canteens." Laura Nelson set her hands on her hips. "Does it look to you like I'm putting together some kind of army out here?" "No, ma'am, it does not." "Go have your look around, deputy, and if you find my flat iron that went missing a month ago, you just let me know." After George Loney disappeared inside her cabin and L.W. guided Gorgeous slowly back to the shed they called the barn, Laura stood very still in her yard. I could tell we were both watching a little bird hopping from branch to branch in the locust tree at the side of the road, backlit by the sun. Hard to tell what it was exactly until it started to sing, and then I knew it for a warbler with that sweet falling song that sounds like two birds singing. "It's beautiful, Laura," I cried, because I was 12 years old and my heart was lifted by things like small birds and Lodal's curly eyelashes and the Winslow's roller skates. I knew Laura was saving her pay from my mama to buy L.W. for his next birthday. I passed Lodal to her, and Laura looked sorrowfully at her baby girl. "Ain't enough beautiful anywhere in this world," she said with a shiver. We left it, Laura and me, that I'd come help myself to eggs on Tuesday after school, which was why I was inside the chicken coop that afternoon. I'd ridden my bike over the rough yard to the far side of the coop, where I let it drop into the switchgrass, and I figured Laura and L.W. were hacking a kudzu around the field at the far side of the cabin. Kudzu is what Laura called stranglevine, because it grew thick and wild and cut off the light and air from everything else that wanted to grow, if you didn't stay after it with a hatchet and no mercy. With a quick look at the eastern sky where the clouds were darkening up, I let myself into the chicken coop, which was empty except for white speckled eggs. I never minded the smells of the coop or the feathers that floated up when all I did was get close and breathe on them. I had brought a basket from home, lined with clean rags, to keep the eggs safe on the ride back, safe as I could, but I always lost a couple. I had just pulled 2 fine eggs out of the straw when I heard hoofs outside in Laura's yard, peeked out between the slats of the coop, and saw Deputy Loney. He slid easily off his dappled gray and flung the reins back over the same buck brush he'd used a few days ago. I watched him stand kind of uncertainly there in the yard for a few moments, heaving a sigh like maybe he didn't want to be back, but that's why they called it work. The sun was low over the road to Darktown, 3 miles off, and the deputy wiped his brow, pulled back his shoulders, and started off in no hurry to find Laura. Suddenly I heard a sound off to the side of the coop, something coming through the thin woods. A horse snorted. I had to crane my neck to see through different slats, to see what was happening off to the side there. Something that didn't want any attention was coming closer. Then I saw him. It was the sheriff, no denying, leaving his fine chestnut horse back in the trees. As he moved silently closer to the yard, I kept losing him from slat to slat. It was hard to see what his face could tell me. When I saw him step just into the yard and saw a rifle in his right hand, I started to gasp and clamped my hand over my mouth. Tom Darnley braced his legs, raised his rifle, and called out, "George!" From my hiding place, where I didn't draw so much as a breath, I watched the deputy turn around, and the very last thing he did in this life was to manage an unsuspecting half-smile for Ella Joy's husband, who shot him dead. 2 crack shots, his body jerking back before it fell, there in Laura Nelson's yard. Then the sheriff whipped the rifle underhanded in the direction of the body. I only just saw the blood spreading on the deputy's shirt front before I lost sight of anything at all, for maybe a minute. As good as blind, my eggless hand shaking out in front of me. When I could see again, I heard cries, heard Laura and L.W. running closer from out back. The sheriff nowhere in sight. The horse in the woods, gone. When Laura saw the deputy, she stopped dead in her tracks, her arm holding back L.W., who ran into her. Then her head reared back, and she scanned the skies, stricken for the truth that was too long in coming. And her shoulders dropped hard, and she shrieked. I was trembling all over, my fingertips on my face like they were checking to see whether life was possible inside this chicken coop, if death and betrayal was that close to me just outside. And in that moment that Laura was right, I saw it. Ain't enough beautiful anywhere. I stumbled wailing out of the coop with my basket, which was when Laura and L.W. found me, and we grabbed each other, and all life was infernally slippery then, like the greased pig contest at the county fair every summer. I clutched at her arms. It was the sheriff, I'll tell them all, I'll tell everybody what I saw, I cried. And it was Laura who first heard the combined sounds of horses and a Model T's coming at a pretty good clip, not too far off. The chickens were squawking and flapping all over the yard, but nowhere near the red-stained body lying still in the dirt that never changed, whatever happened. L.W. held up my bike, his deep, sad eyes on me, when his mama said, "There's time to tell them all later, later, baby, and now you get on home, through the woods, and don't let them see you. You're faster than any cyclone I ever knew, so just go fast now. You're my own Josie Cyclone, you hear?" She stroked my hair when I should have been stroking hers. But I believed her when she said later. And I fell on L.W., who taught me Cat's Cradle and Hucklebuckle Beanstalk and Blind Man's Buff, which wasn't too much fun with just two, so we usually ended up laughing and falling out in the dirt, which always seemed more the point than groping around with the blindfold. Only then, as he shoved my bike at me, which he pointed into the woods, he looked older than practically anyone I knew. And there were two streams of tears on his cheeks, which showed up better on a black face than a white. Then I disappeared into the woods, my basket slung over my handlebars just as the horses and cars pulled up at Laura's, and men swarmed the yard. I heard someone shout, "There's George! Oh, shit, he's shot dead!" And Tom Darnley's voice over everybody's, "I knew there'd be trouble with these niggers. Glad I asked y'all along. Could have been the both of you laying there dead, Tom. Only wish poor George had waited for me. Now, Tom, this ain't the time to go thinking about that. There's the weapon. Grab them niggers." And over all of them I heard Laura's fierce cries, "My baby girl, let me get my baby girl." And as I got deeper into the woods, I knew there was no good place for Lodal Nelson, not crying by her little self alone in the empty cabin, and not keeping company with her mom and brother wherever in creation they were headed. Mama gave me soup while I told her what I saw, her slim fingers drumming the table. I could tell from her eyes that she was paying very close attention. And I kept sputtering the soup, what with crying I couldn't help. That night I slept in her bed and we lay in each other's arms in our matching white dimity nightgowns she had paid Laura to make us by hand. Mama felt a little bony to me, like she needed more happiness or potatoes in her life. Not these troublesome Okima fifth graders who only talked tough about protecting what was theirs, like that was anything at all out here in a dust bowl that no improvement could change. But I didn't want to cry about that too. I had just enough just then with L.W. and Laura. Through the gap in her curtains before I drifted off, blubbering something about baby Lodal, I saw Mama's green eyes wide open and staring in the moonlight slanting through. Her hairpins were sticking up here and there out of her hair. She had worked loose, hardly noticing, while I told her everything. She had barely said a word all evening, just shushing me and clucking at me while she thought. The next day, she put on her best teaching shirtwaist dress in pale yellow and went down the main street of Okima, collecting the gossip. When she came back, she told me the Nelsons were in the jailhouse at the end of town, that the sheriff was laying around the tale that when Deputy Loney returned to check out the matter of stolen goods again, one of the Nelsons, thought was L.W., shot him dead, and that the circuit magistrate was making his rounds and was due in Okima sometime week after next, which was what everyone was righteously waiting for, including the Nelsons. There was some talk about niggers getting too above themselves in these parts, and some talk about poor handsome George Loney, who was such a good family man, now leaving a wife and three young ones, shot down in cold blood in the line of duty, which is every true citizen's unholy nightmare. Mama actually got in to see Laura and L.W., stepping around Sheriff Tom Darnley, who made sure to block her way just enough with his barrel chest that she was forced to touch him as she went. She had seen this behavior in mean dogs, she told me, and knew what it was. Laura and L.W. were in separate cells, what with just cracked slop jars and rough cots, L.W. silent and sorrowful, clutching the ragged jail pillow, and Laura quietly nursing baby Lodel, whose little hand tried to land peacefully on Laura's cheek. "No," said Laura, "we don't need anything, Audra, just the magistrate. The magistrate will see it for what it is," she went on, nodding kind of serenely in complete confidence. "And then we'll be needing our Josie." "Let the law sort it out," was what Mama told anybody on the street over the next 2 days when she overheard whispers about high time we go clear out Darktown once and for all, and who's to say our pure white women folk are safe from these vicious creatures ain't fit to be in polite society. Mama asked one group of whisperers exactly what polite society they were referring to, but then they sniffed at her, spat something about maybe she's not fit to teach their precious young, and moved off. By that evening, the whispers ended, and Deputy George Loney was being mourned loudly in every place from the Okema Baptist Church to Dugan's Bar. Loney was now the finest, the holiest, the tallest, the crackest shot, the tenderest father, the steadiest drinker, the best angler, whistler, spitter west of the damn Mississippi. And by that evening, Laura and L.W., were lawless, dangerous devils, responsible for lightning strikes, failed crops, and every personal disappointment suffered by a white person west of the damn Mississippi. After dark, we mistook the deep and sudden quiet everywhere for folks coming to their senses and turning toward home in shame at their idle talk. But then we heard trouble down at the far end of Okema, near the jail, near the lumberyard, where usually the worst that got planned were shiveries and ice cream socials. Mama stepped out of our house and looked far up the street. Except for a dim light in Ella Joy's, all the neighbors' houses were dark. A stray dog slunk past in the other direction, bouncing lightly on silent feet. Its scrawny head pointed out of a town where maybe he could no longer trust the scraps. Suddenly, Mama told me to go grab my basket, and I hurried up the street behind her, trying to keep up. Outside the jailhouse, the electric globe lights were bright, and the double doors were standing wide open. From there, we watched distant lanterns swinging through the moonlit night, jostling along the road in their wagons, headed west out of Okema toward the Canadian River. Except for the thin, far-off voices singing Onward Christian Soldiers, you might have mistook the lantern lights for eyes of nighttime animals out hunting, doing their business in the dark. And maybe they were. I followed Mama up the steps into the jailhouse, which was empty, except for the old, bald jailer named Broom, who had ropes looped loosely around his wrists and ankles, sitting there in a chair tipped back against the wall. He was reading the latest issue of Feed News. Mama looked quickly around at the empty jail, eyed the doorway to the cells, and took a deep breath as Broom looked up at her. Then she said an extraordinary thing. "I'm here for my baby," she declared. "What baby are you talking about, Miss Templet?" "The one Laura Nelson's been minding for me. Where is she?" Broom sat up in his chair and leered at her. "That black baby ain't yours." Mama shouted, "Are you telling me I don't know my own child? Now where is she?" "It plumb belongs where the sheriff and the others took the other two, only I expect they'll be back for it." And he gave her a dark look. "Only next time they won't bother to go so far out of town." Mama disregarded the jailer and strode down the corridor to the cells. There in the cell that had held Laura, baby Lodel was fast asleep, swaddled in blankets, and tucked as far underneath the rough cot as Laura could get her. We scooped her up, blankets and all, set her in my basket, and headed out. "Hey," said Broom, "you two are stealing the property of Oak Fuskett County Sheriff's Department, same as a chair or a slop jar, which is punishable." "Go to hell," snapped Mama. We rushed around the corner to the livery stable, roused the stable boy, who was one of Mama's fifth graders, and paid him to hitch a good fast horse to a buckboard. When he was done, still complaining about long division being the devil's work, Mama told him he really has to look past long division to find the devil's work. We climbed up, my heart pounding as I huddled over the basket, and he handed up a lantern he didn't even charge us for, then let go of the bridle. We set out in the dark, alone along the road they had traveled, Laura and L.W., Mama driving the horse as fast as she knew how. As bats swooped silently around us and around us, jerking after a meal, I set Lodal's basket between my feet and held up the lantern, not daring to ask Mama where we were going. I thought the sheriff was moving the Nelsons to another jail in another town, away from all the godforsaken talk about setting fire to Darktown, somewhere they'd be safe until the magistrate came and I could tell what I saw of the murder, somewhere none of us would have to be afraid of Tom Darnley ever again when they slap him in chains for the cold-blooded murder of his deputy. I wouldn't even let myself wonder why I even thought it made sense for his killer to be protecting the very people he set up to take the blame for his deed. I wouldn't even let myself wonder why the very people of Okemah, who were calling the Nelsons bloodthirsty, unchristian monkeys, would be riding along with the sheriff and his new deputies while they transferred them. The road widened under thick, overhanging tree limbs, and as we got close to the bridge over the Canadian River, I heard an owl hooting out of sight of slingshots and buckshot and the dark beliefs of the group. Ahead in the dark were lanterns, some swinging, some still, and thin voices singing, "Long as earth endureth, men of faith will hold. Kingdoms, nations, empires, in destruction rule." I felt alarmed. "What's going on, Mama?" She pulled back on the reins and left the buckboard lurched half off the road. "Is it a prayer meeting?" As we climbed out of the buckboard, me grabbing the basket with baby Lodal, we heard other stronger voices shouting commands. And then there were a few moments of absolute stony silence, as if every soul except me and Mama and Lodal was safe in bed back in town and not out here in the strange night. What followed was a loud wail. Laura. It was Laura wailing, and my skin crawled. And up went a rush of voices, a great shout of satisfaction, whoops, shots fired up into the moonlit sky. We climbed down through the bushes, pushing aside branches, stumbling over roots until the ground leveled out on the banks of the Canadian River. A few townspeople holding lanterns were scattered along both sides of the river, a slow and dark and winding thing in the Oklahoma night. But the crowd was writhing like a single strange creature up on the bridge in the pale moonlight. The singing started up again, and more voices joined in, although few seemed to really know the words and were left mumbling out of tune. And I could just make out the sheriff in the thick of the crowd, his arms crossed, barking directions while others were grappling with a struggling woman. Laura. And then I spied L.W. and swallowed a shriek as Mama clutched my arm hard. We struggled along the riverbank with our baby basket, pushing past the wife of the owner of the lumberyard. Annoyed, I stepped on her hem, pushing past the assistant bank manager. My L.W., my hucklebuckle cat's cradle blind man's buff L.W., his hands tied behind his back, was dangling from a rope, strung off the bridge. Laura's slow and dutiful boy had come to a stop in the moonlight. They had pulled down his pants, which were crumpled around his naked feet. Some shadows were hanging over the bridge to get a better look. And I knew then there was just the smallest sliver between life and no life at all. And the only thing that pushes those two things apart wasn't anything I was ever going to find here. And I swear my heart flew up to her there, where we watched Laura struggle against the noose pushed down over her head. Mama screamed Laura's name, holding up baby Lodl, whose eyes were blinking awake as high as she could. And then Mama screamed her name again. And I swear in that moment, Laura stopped struggling and wailing for LW, who would now never get those roller skates to skate him away from the world of whites. And she faced out, looking toward us in the shivering night. Mama held up baby Lodl for her to see, held her right up. And me and Mama and Laura and baby Lodl were the only ones perfectly alive and still in the light of all those scattered lanterns. And I needed to believe in those seconds before several hands lifted her into the air. She saw. As the singing crowed, "Onward then, ye people, join our happy throng," Laura was flung off the bridge. Once again, that roar of satisfaction went up loud in the godforsaken night, like an unnatural waterfall flowing up, up to whatever dark place it came from. As Laura's weight against the noose snapped her neck, in her calico print dress, with her good and capable hands at her sides, like LW before her, she finally came to a stop. In the glare of light from the lanterns and the moon, Laura's mouth was closed and set, and her brow was wrinkled, like she was studying hard on a problem. Maybe about how to attack that kudzu, or whether baby Lodl would find some white luck and get a different life, or even just a life. Or maybe my Laura was studying hard on wickedness itself, and for that, she'd need more time than she was getting. The first day afterwards, Mama waited for the law, or the odd fellows who like to keep things orderly, to cut them down, but none came. The second day, Mama waited for just common decent folk to cut them down, but none came. Which is not to say the bridge didn't draw a crowd of gawkers, women in white dresses with parasols, men with starched collars, and a photographer who set up his box camera just a little ways downriver and motioned with his arm for them all to gather round more closely over the place where the corpses hung, so no one's left out. On the third day, me and Mama got two men from Darktown to come help with Laura and LW. Pretty soon traffic would start up again on this bridge over the Canadian River. But for now, there was only us. And I ran halfway across and went down on my knees. Grunting, I sawed the ropes with a skinning knife. Saw one of the men wading into the river, swiping sweat off his head with his forearm, muttering how I shouldn't be looking at poor LW. It wasn't decent. His Mama worked a pike staff to pull Laura's body closer to shore. She told him that anyone looking at LW's pants is paying attention to the wrong thing. The men agreed to bury them on the Nelson farm, and Mama offered them gorgeous and the chickens, which the men appreciated. And then Mama suggested that the Nelson farm might make a good home for a new family. The man who mentioned about LW's pants halfway smiled when he said something about there being a whole passel of stranglevine at Nelson's place. But it's just a matter of keeping on top of it, for sure. Elsewise, there's no light or air or rain gets through. Me and Mama watched as they loaded the soaked and swollen bodies of Laura and L.W. Nelson into their wagon. And I started to cry, pushing my fists against my own chest, howling about their missing shoes. As the wagon bumped its way back up the road, I yelled I'd make it right. I swore I'd make it right. I'd tell that magistrate whenever he got here what I saw. I swore I'd tell. "There's no making it right," said Mama, holding my arms and making me look her in the face. "But we know what happened. We've got two dead Negroes and a little white Yankee girl. We've got nothing they care about. But Mama, we've got nothing." June 3rd. I pull my arm away from my mouth and stand listening to the sounds here by the Canadian River, remembering Laura's studying expression, the last on her face in this lifetime. I'm studying too, listening to the vireos call back and forth to each other out of sight high in the hackberry trees, and I'm studying the weep of a call and the hollow hammering of a woodpecker. There's just a little breeze now, fluttering the leaves of the skunk bushes that have their own soft song on this very last day I can look for Laura and L.W.'s shoes before we leave Okima for good. Me and Lodal and Mama, who's arranged for the man worried about me and L.W.'s pants to take us all the way to Tulsa in Laura's wagon, pulled by Gorgeous, who will get us to the train bound for Philadelphia just fine. I know I'll never find those shoes. I am resigned. The cows, wherever in their sturdy ways they are, have moved on while I stand here studying Sheriff Tom Darnley, half dead with drink in the rotten skiff that belongs to nobody anymore. I think about Ella Joy, who I hardly recognized the day after the deputy died, her arm in a sling and a patch of her blonde hair pulled clean out of her scalp. And I think about George Loney, who might not have been the truest husband this side of the Mississippi, but who called Laura ma'am and had no reason to think he wasn't turning unarmed toward a friend that day in Laura's yard. And I think about the hymn singing and the lanterns held up that night so nobody would miss a thing. That thing the photographer was now selling around town as picture postcards to send to your friends and family in other places to show them about Oklahoma law and the latest fashions. And I think about the eggs hitting our windows after got around we cut down what Mama's fifth graders called them niggers. But mostly as I study just how big those gaping holes are in the skiff holding the sheriff, and just how far away the deepest, fastest part of the Canadian River is from where I'm standing, I think about Kudzu. I really do. And I see my Laura with a hatchet, keeping after the strangle vine that keeps out all the light and air and rain from everything else that grows. I untie the long, strong rope pulled taut that holds the skiff to the trunk of a black walnut tree set well back from the water. Then I loop the end around the low-hanging branches of a buckbrush close to the riverbank, just to be sporting, wondering while the vireos sing to me whether I've done enough studying. We've got nothing, Mama told me after we cut them down, but I find myself sorely doubting that. Then I dig my feet in hard at the bow of the skiff, and I set to work, putting all my strength into slowly shoving the sheriff out on the river.
That was Shelley Costa reading her story, Stranglevine, from the November 2012 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. This podcast was produced with the help of our assistant editor, Jackie Sherbo. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital versions are available also from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Google, Magster, Sony, and Zinio. Thanks for listening.